Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, November 28th. I'm your humble host, PK, and I would again like to thank our hosts at bbsradio.com for always promoting free speech and free thought. I'm into promoting free speech and free markets, free minds and free markets, a lot going on in the news. On this station, I talk about geopolitics, current events, history, economics, Zionism, Israel. And since I don't have Zionist masters in Zionist corporate control over what I have to say and do, and my thoughts, I have a lot more freedom than the status quo media. Because the status quo media is controlled by, I believe, a Zionist control, has a very heavy pro-Israel slant to it, and it just serves the apparatus of the state, which is state control and a very cozy relationship between industry and government, which leads to fascism. It's a softer fascism than Mussolini's, but nevertheless, it's the path we're going down that I certainly do not like, including the bailouts and all this sort of thing. Now, on foreign policy, we see that, once again, the U.S. war machine, the federal government, has now caused the death of 2 dozen Pakistani soldiers. And, of course, this is resented by Pakistan and their neighbors, and it's only going to make things worse. I wonder if there's the same public outcry and sympathy for these dead Pakistani soldiers as much as for these dead Pakistani soldiers as there were for all those SEALs killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan recently. Yes, the war machine keeps marching forward, and the military presence is just playing a shell game. Yeah, he's going to pull troops out of Iraq, but there'll still be a lot of troops there, and they're going to pull some, apparently, into Kuwait, where they can just pounce, on a moment's notice. But, this quagmire just continues. It's cost us trillions of dollars. Money that could have been invested in our own economy, and it hasn't kept us safer. And meanwhile, military suicides are at an all-time high. I forgot to mention that this is a pre-recorded show today, and my guest today is coming back. I believe it's probably his third visit, is my friend Stephen Lenman, who's a noted journalist, essayist, fellow intellectual and author. And Stephen has been on a few more times. Stephen also has a Jewish background, and I think of him as the anti-Zionist camp. So we speak freely about our criticisms of the Middle East, about Zionism and Israel, and we don't hold any punches. So I would like to welcome Stephen back to Third Stream View. Are you out there, Stephen?
Oh, I sure am, PK, and absolutely. Pulling no punches is your stock and trade, and it's my stock and trade, especially, PK, I want to emphasize, especially on the most hot-button issues. The hotter they are, the less I hold back.
Well, I appreciate that. Before we continue, would you care for some tea or coffee?
No cream or sugar, please.
Okay, well, as you know, it's self-service, my friend. Now, Stephen, back to our hard-hitting style. You and I both probably, let me ask you first, back in 2003 when the war drums were banging, before we went to war, and even post 9/11, were you feeling hostility from maybe friends or family members when you stated, when we spoke about, well, U.S. foreign policy has blowback. Did you get that, you know, some of that hostility back then?
You mean about my criticism of Israel?
Not just Israel, but, I mean, the U.S. foreign policy that causes this blowback of the interventionism and the militarism, you know, did you get some of that vibe from people about, they question your patriotism, in other words?
Not a great deal, and not too much from family members. I have a feeling that in my family, people either are not as politically into things as they should be, or if they are, they just don't say very much about it, at least to people like me, who I'm sure have a different point of view than a lot of them. I don't think it's true across the board. I have one family member who doesn't agree with me on everything, but she follows my writing. She sends me very complimentary emails. Most of the others don't say much, if anything, so I honestly don't know what they're thinking. And to me, that's a weather vane I would like to get a reading on, but I'm unable
sure.
to do it. As far as my writing overall, since I began PK, the percentage of negative emails I get is very minuscule. The great, great majority, 95% at least, is positive to very positive.
Oh, that's great because, well, I myself, on 9/11, I myself said that day that the chickens have come home to roost. And by that, I meant U.S. foreign policy has blowback by the federal government. I always say federal government. I don't like to say we because we is you and I, Stephen, and the people. There's us and then there's the federal government because you live in the great state or formerly great state of Illinois. Now, Springfield cannot station troops overseas. Springfield cannot conscript you. Springfield cannot declare war on other countries. It's the federal government. And I had a discussion a couple weeks ago with another guest about, I say that he's talking about corporate power, and I understand corporate power, and I hope you'll agree with me on this, Stephen, is that any big company, GM, Ford, any huge company, you want to name Exxon, they cannot draft or conscript you. They might be able to influence the federal government, but they themselves cannot declare war. They cannot attack other countries. Only the federal government does their bidding. So I'm looking at the source, not the symptom.
Well, of course, nobody can conscript us now. The draft went out in the 1970s, PK, but there's sort of a backdoor draft, meaning the job market is so bad that young kids, if they want a paycheck, too many of them decide the only way they can get it is by joining the military. Unfortunately, what doesn't cross their mind when they're thinking about how am I going to feed my family and so on is if I do this, maybe I'll get my brains blown out. So then my military service will be short, my benefits will be meager, and I won't be able to support my family. They make a very, very bad choice. As far as the corporations go, PK, America wages wars at their behest. So let's put the onus on their back because they make so much money out of wars. War profiteering isn't just to the defense contractors. It's to all of the industries that benefit when America goes to war. The companies that rebuild what we blow up, the technology companies that make the sophisticated technologies that operate these weapons. It goes on and on and on. And then when a country is conquered, everybody comes in not just to exploit the resources, but to do things like what Monsanto did to Iraq. Monsanto, food, well, it replaced indigenous crops with GMO crops. They literally poisoned the entire Iraqi agricultural landscape with poisoned, toxic GMO crops that farmers can't afford, so they get put out of business. Agribusiness moves in their place. And this is the best of all possible worlds. I mean, it just goes on and on, PK. I mean, this is ugly stuff. And of course, it just keeps getting worse all the time.
We've discussed this before, Stephen. Not to mention, you talked about GMOs, which I'm not exactly pro or con on per se. I'm still sort of out on that. But
be con.
I don't. Well, I don't. I don't support any government subsidizing of agriculture or any other thing. And the big shots get the biggest subsidies. But you also, let me add to what you said about pollution in Iraq and this and that, is all the depleted uranium, including in Afghanistan. Perhaps you've seen, or maybe some of our listeners have seen, the deformed Iraqi babies, horribly deformed by that depleted uranium dust throughout the country.
Absolutely. It's been a good while, PK, but I wrote about it back when I began writing. It wasn't an initial article, but very early when I began writing in summer 2005, I wrote about depleted uranium. Indeed, I've seen the pictures of deformed kids. You don't want to look at those kids because they don't look like human babies. They look like something that's unrecognizable, and that's from radiation poisoning. And
exactly.
Then when the young guys come back from a war theater like Iraq, they give the problem to their wives, to their spouses, or a spouse may give it to a husband. I mean, this is ugly stuff. We're not talking about a small percentage of people harmed. We're talking about many tens of thousands. And, you know, Gulf War syndrome. Really, rather than having a name like that, you need to get very specific. You got the effects of depleted uranium. All kinds of other toxins are used in the war zones, toxic chemicals. I mean, just a toxic stew of poison, toxic stuff that anybody there, whether it's U.S. forces, the local population, they're all affected by it. The whole landscape is poison, and the people are poison. And it's a terrible, terrible problem. And this stuff doesn't go away easily. The radiation will stay there virtually forever. And the other stuff, my God, for many, many years, maybe generations.
You're correct. I do not disagree with you at all. However, also, in this disastrous war, as you probably know, but I'll state it anyway, military suicides at an all-time high.
Oh, yeah.
High level of divorces for military members, high levels of spousal abuse, high levels of homelessness for veterans. And, you know, the military doesn't pay crap to these guys. They put their lives on the line. What they get paid is ridiculous. And, you know, their benefits are, you know, so-so. And then you've had, in the not so long ago, if not still, there's been military families on food stamps. So, you know, they've just made it worse. And this, again, is the federal government. It's the federal government who's doing this stuff. And all these companies you spoke about going in to rebuild these countries and the nation building, they are all gouging at the tax trough. So you say that corporations, you know, push this stuff, and I don't disagree. You're correct. But corporations, if any corporation sent you a draft notice or declared war on another country or tried to tax you directly, you'd laugh at them. They have to use the power of the state. They have to use the power of the state, and that's where I'm coming from. And Stephen, the federal government remains the largest polluter in the country. When you include all the military hazardous waste and the nuclear stuff, the federal government is the largest polluter in the country.
Well, there's no question about that. The Pentagon is the greatest polluter on the planet, PK.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, it's been a while. Project Censored did a story about them a few years ago. And I remember seeing it, reading it. I don't remember the data, but it's just horrific stuff. And the Pentagon gets a waiver on environmental laws that our country passes. And of course, when they go into another country, they don't worry about the laws of those countries. And if they occupy the country, then America writes the laws. They just get rid of whatever existed, and America writes the laws to give give U.S. forces, to give U.S. Companies coming in carte blanche to do whatever they want. Local people have no rights. Local government has no sovereignty. It's we're boss, and what we say goes. And if anybody doesn't like it, we'll blow their brains out.
Stephen, you're correct.
That's the world order, PK.
You're correct, and sorry, but I'm laughing a little bit. I'm not laughing because I'm laughing at people suffering. I laugh at these idiotic politicians and their policies. But once again, America didn't blow them up. You and I didn't blow them up. The federal government did it. It's the federal. I always try to clarify. It's the federal government. This is the same government who dropped bombs on Japan, nuclear bombs on Japan, after Japan was already defeated and pleading for a peace resolution through backdoors diplomacy. So, you know, that's where my big deal is on this. Now, I want to shift the conversation because I can. It's my show, but you're my man. Anyway, I read some of the things you wrote about Occupy Wall Street, and I was in agreement with much of it. But let me give you my take on Occupy Wall Street or any of the other places. I'm in very narrow agreement on them. I'm totally opposed to any tax-financed bailouts. I'm totally opposed to crony capitalism. I'm opposed to the wars completely. I'm opposed to subsidies and government protection for the politically privileged. And I empathize with our young people who've got all this college debt. There's no jobs. So, you know, the federal government has created this mess as well as the Federal Reserve. And this is why when Ron Paul continues to speak at college campuses, the young people roar for this man.
Well, absolutely. There are two issues I agree with Ron Paul on. I'm afraid only those two. He wants to end the Federal Reserve. I absolutely agree with that, and he wants to end America's imperial wars. He and I will get along splendidly on those two topics. Here's my big issue, and my new book that came out, amazing timing, in September. My new book is called How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War. And just by chance, it happened to come out in September. And the theme of my book, PK, is simply this. Private people, private institutions, Wall Street are the private institutions. They have money power in violation of the Constitution's Article 1, Section 8, that says only the Congress has money power. That is the cancer that's killing the country and killing the world. Money power in private hands to make more of it for them at our expense. And my number one issue is returning money power to public hands the way the Constitution says. I don't want to get rid of a central bank. I want to nationalize it. I want Congress, the U.S. Treasury, to run it, not Wall Street. And what does Wall Street do, PK? Doesn't contribute to productive economic growth. In the old days, we had an industrial America. That's disappearing. The jobs have gone overseas, the cheap labor markets. We have a service economy, something like 88%, and most of the service jobs are low pay, low benefit. People need two of them. People need husband and wife. They need both of them working, maybe multiple jobs each, just to make ends meet. The poverty in America, the Census Bureau data, grossly understates it because they use a 40-year-old threshold. The poverty rate in America affects over one-third of U.S. families, U.S. households. Household is the correct term, meaning an individual household, whether it has one person in it, two, ten, whatever the number is. Over one-third of America's households are impoverished. For a family of four, PK, the official poverty threshold is $22,400. One person in Chicago can't live on that kind of money. I couldn't survive very well on $22,400. My God, rent, food, medical care, just the essentials. Forget the frills, just the essentials. You need more money than that. Now, if you never get sick, and you can live on the most meager food supply, and maybe minimal amounts of it, and live in a rundown something or other somewhere on the wrong side of town, maybe you could scrape by. Not too well, but maybe you could scrape by. But this is the system that money power in private hands gives us. There've been two times in U.S. history, PK, when it wasn't that way. In colonial America and under Lincoln during the Civil War, the states in colonial times controlled its own money, not the Bank of England, not the Crown, and the federal government controlled America's money, not the bankers, during the Civil War. So America and the states could borrow money interest-free. So one obvious question is, why should the country pay interest on its own money to bankers? Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't. And of course, Jefferson and Jackson abolished the first and second bank of the U.S. in their days. So the whole premise of Ron Paul, of course, Austrian economics, is we're opposed to central banking. Now, you'd rather have it nationalized. Well, if they do that, I hope they don't still keep printing money out of thin air, because the Constitution calls for the coining of money, gold and silver. So the currency should be backed by something, and that's led to this mess that we're in. All this the housing boom. If you see, Ron Paul has speeches from 2002, 2003, exactly forecasting what was going to happen to the economy and all this. And sure enough, it did. And what does Greenspan and Krugman and Bernanke want? They want more inflation. They want, bigger stimulus packages. Well, that's like a bridge to nowhere. It's not, it's just temporary. We need more production and growth. So, it's such a mess. Let me just mention one more thing. You said you're in agreement with Ron Paul about the wars and the Fed, and I would hope you're in agreement with him about ending the drug war. You and I spoke about the drug war in the past, and we're on the same page. And I remember to mention this to you today, my friend, is that based on your wonderful journalism and your essays and your investigative journalism, I would love, if you ever get the chance, I would love to see what you come up with about the tragedy of America, the federal government's drug war, and what it's done internationally. And of course, its origins, which were racist. They were directed against blacks, Latinos, and of course then musicians. And when you look at the origins of the drug war and how it's imposed on other countries, Colombia and all these other countries, American bases, and of course CIA has been running opium and cocaine for years.
Oh, absolutely. I'm 100% in agreement with you on that, PK, and with Ron Paul on drugs. The drug war is literally a war on humanity, and
exactly.
It does no good whatsoever. Why have a war on a substance that people want to destroy their own bodies, well, I say they have a right to do it. The government doesn't own our bodies. If we want to destroy them, that's our right. I think it's crazy to do it, but absolutely, the CIA, almost since inception, has been heavily involved in drug trafficking. The major banks, again, are heavily involved in laundering drug money. The whole business, the Taliban, before the Afghan war, eradicated the poppy fields, mostly in the 1990s. And that was
true.
One of the sins they committed, because Washington wanted the drug trade to flourish because it's so profitable. They don't want the Taliban to make money from it, but they want the CIA to be able to do it and the Wall Street banks to be able to do it. I remember hearing a program, Max Keiser, who has some wonderful financial analysis. He worked on Wall Street in the 1980s, and I remember one of his programs, PK, when he would say one of the standing jokes on Wall Street was, every Friday afternoon, apparently his office was near Citibank, so he talked about Citibank. He said every Friday afternoon, the limousines drove up to Citibank, and people came out of them with suitcases, and the suitcases were filled with money, and the money went right into the bank to be laundered.
Yeah, and now we have had for a while British and American troops guarding poppy fields in Afghanistan.
Oh, absolutely.
So yes, some is destroyed, but that's a smokescreen. Yes, some is destroyed, but behind that, there's a lot going on.
Oh, there's a hell of a lot going on. And again, there's too much. There is more money in illegal drugs than legal drugs. I mean, enormous money. I've seen figures. I've written about this a little bit. I don't write about it that often, but I have written about it. I've seen numbers that go up as high as $1.5 trillion a year, the market for illicit drugs. $1.5 trillion a year. I mean, that is big, big stuff.
You're speaking globally, right?
globally, yeah.
Yeah, because as I understand it, the drug war that Nixon really kicked up since, was it 70, 69 or 70, something like that, it's been a tragic waste of $1 trillion just in enforcement.
Oh, well, you know, this is part of the dirty game.
I mean, the whole package.
The prison industrial complex,
yes,
PK.
Yes.
And over half of the people, I've seen different figures on this, and I've seen figures as high as two-thirds of those in federal and state prisons, mostly state, because the states have a lot more prisons than the federal government, but combined, let's say two-thirds are nonviolent, about half of those are drug-related. All of those people shouldn't be in prison. They should be out somewhere. Why do you put people in prison? And if you're a multiple offender, well, you three strikes and you're out, PK. You know, you get put in prison three times for abusing your own body, and it's a life sentence.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, you talk about a police state law, but this happens to growing numbers of people.
Well, yeah, and they haven't learned from Prohibition, which was a colossal failure. And one other thing that Ron Paul would do was he would pardon all nonviolent drug users. Our prisons only should have violent criminals in them, and everything else should be based on restitution. But the drug war causes more criminals. It leads to more unemployment and poverty and despair. It has its tentacles in so many ways that people don't even realize it.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, the policies stem from our government, PK, and we literally have to hold the people holding public office accountable. And it doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Let's call them what they are. They're part of America's duopoly. There's no two-party state. There's a one-party state with two wings. And they basically agree. Rhetorically, they disagree for their constituencies. So the Republicans sound meaner and tougher, and the Democrats sound softer and kinder. But behind the scenes, in their dirty back rooms, they are 100% in agreement down the line on the issues that matter most when it comes to imperial wars, when it comes to all the banker bailouts and the other corporate handouts, when it comes to maintaining the prison industrial complex and the war on drugs and all of these horrific things. And they disagree on things like, and they're not unimportant to the people affected, they disagree on things like maybe gay rights, stem cell research, you know, things
right.
like that.
Right.
And they're not unimportant, but they certainly don't measure up to imperial wars or ripping off the country for multi-trillions of dollars. I mean, that's where the rubber really meets the road, and that's where the country literally is going down the drain. America is slowly dying, PK. It's not the country I grew up with. I grew up I was born in the 30s, but the life that I remember began in the late 30s. 1940s, 1950s, there were lots of warts back then, lots of problems. We had the segregation, just all kinds of problems. But compared to today, it was heaven. It was heaven. Something needs to be done to restore what we had, but we're going in exactly the opposite direction. And literally, America is running itself into the ground. And heaven help the young people today. I say things like, I would never want to be a young person in America today. I don't know what they have to look forward to. Most of them have nothing to look forward to. PK, I went to a top school, to say the least, college and grad school in the 1950s. The tuition at my school was about as high as at any private school. In my freshman year in 1952, the total year's tuition was $600.
Yeah.
$600. You could go evenings at $5 a course and get a Harvard degree, which my mother did. She got a Harvard degree and graduated with me in the same class in 1956. Her degree cost her $175. I mean, that sounds too crazy to be true, but it was true. I don't know whether that program still exists. For sure, tuitions like I paid no longer exist. They started going up over my 4 years. My senior year tuition was $1,000, and if you lived at school with all expenses, double that amount. I needed no loans. My parents helped me a little bit. I worked during the school year and during summers. I came out debt-free. I had to borrow a little bit in graduate school after the Army. I don't recall my graduate school tuition. It was pretty cheap, too, but it was by the semester hour. That's the way the system worked at the Wharton School. And basically, I got out of there very cheap as well. But I needed a little help. I worked, again, part-time, and I went straight through, so there was no full-time summer job. But I needed to borrow, it was either $200 or $300, and I easily paid that off in less than my first working year. There were no onerous interest rates. There were none of the rules that exist today. And the kids today come out of college deeply in debt. There is no way to default on it. You are debt entrapped for life. It is the worst kind of debt bondage to be in, worse than your mortgage, worse than your credit card, worse than any other kind of debt, and millions of kids will suffer grievously, too many of them, for the rest of their working lives, and this will follow you into your retirement years if you haven't paid off your debt. They can garnish your wages. They can garnish your Social Security, if it's still around, which I doubt. They can strip you of what you have. I'm not certain if they can strip the roof over your head, but they can take every red cent that you have, unless you send it offshore and hide it someplace. That's the kind of America we live in today. So companies like Fannie Mae is a gangster operation, just like Goldman Sachs, just like J.P. Morgan, just like the rest of them. They're not banks. They're crime syndicates. I hope nobody believes in a system like that.
Well, what you say, there's a lot of, what you say is a lot of correct things, what you say, and I agree with a lot of it. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, those are government-sponsored enterprises. That's corporate welfare, crony capitalism. That you know, we can thank Nixon for some of those. Now, when I wanted to comment briefly on your college experience, and also, were you in the military?
Oh, yeah, I sure was.
Oh, so you're a veteran?
Yep.
Okay, so right now, I didn't know that. I didn't even know that before when we spoke. So, Stephen, immediately, that gives you even more credibility, because if anybody can speak their mind, it should be our vets.
Well, I didn't go in wartime. I was lucky. I
Doesn't matter.
Finished college when the Korean War was over.
Doesn't matter. You served.
Before the Vietnam War began, I was in the service from 1956 through summer 1956 through summer 1958, and then I came out and I went to grad school. So I spent all my time in the U.S., most of it in California. And the most exciting thing that happened during those 2 years that I remember so well I'm talking about a disruptive thing that happened, was in October 1957, TK, when the Soviets launched Sputnik. Oh, my base, Fort Ord went crazy for about 2 or 3 days. And then everything settled down, normal again, back to business, everything was calm. I guess it was like Pearl Harbor before the Japanese bombed in December 1941.
Wow.
You know, everybody, on the weekends you could get up late, have a late breakfast, you know, have a leisurely time of things, nothing to worry about, no enemies. And things were very quiet when I was in the military, so I was very lucky I did not have to go to war.
Well, Stephen, That does beg the question, during your military service era, did you ever get to meet Elvis Presley when you were in the Army?
No, I did not.
I did not.
I think he was in around the time. I have no idea where he was. He got a different job than I got. His job was entertaining the troops.
Yeah.
Just like Ronald Reagan.
Back to the school issue, when you were in school in the 50s, that was before the money supply grew tremendously, and that was before the federal government was heavily involved in education. Ron Paul talks about education. He said when the federal government got involved with the Department of Education and all these bureaucrats, it made everything much more expensive, and you can sort of trace how that's happened. So again, I'm always hammering on the source, the federal government, which subsidizes, that's where the lobbyists go. So that's what we have. Government corrupted and complicated by lobbying. And the great Austrian school economist, our mentor, Ludwig von Mises, used to say that unlike the physical sciences like math, physics, geometry, chemistry, those scientific disciplines are not corrupted or harassed by the pleadings of special interest groups and lobbying groups. Economics has those pressures on it all the time.
Well, very definitely, although I hope you go along with this. Nobody financed me to go to college, PK, even though my preference is to give everybody a chance to be educated in the country. It's the bedrock. It's the seeds that grow the country. After World War II, what catapulted economic growth in the country was the GI Bill. It gave young kids coming home from the war a chance to go to school, get an education, better themselves. It helped them get started in life. It helped them get started with a new home and raising a family. It was at a time when things were much, much cheaper. Things were affordable, but the government gave ordinary people a helping hand, and the country benefited as a result. The country grew from it. I'm a great believer in public education. It's a system I grew up in. I went to an inner-city school that many years ago disappeared. Inner city, if the school existed today, the kids, the teaching level deteriorated so much the way it has in all the big cities and many other ones that literally half the kids or more come out illiterate, not fit for anything. They just push them through to get them out to make way for other kids coming along, and they push them through. And it was so different when I grew up. Again, inner city schools all the way. The teachers were good. The decorum in classrooms was good. There was learning. And those schools got me into Harvard. I mean, that's impossible today, unless you're brilliant and you can literally survive a system that's intended to crush people, not help them. But public education in America is being destroyed. It's being handed over to, it's being made a profit center. Education shouldn't be a profit center. Education should be to educate people so that they can go into society and grow the country and make the country better. But if the population isn't educated, then how can you have a prosperous country over time? Well, the answer is you cannot.
You are correct, and here's where I calmly, politely, warmly, humorously disagree with you. Stephen, education is too important to be left up to the state. Look what the government's terrible at. Look at the post office. Look at the school system. These things are in shambles. I would rather see little private schools popping up everywhere, especially in urban areas, especially in poor areas, free of government control and harassment and indoctrination into statism, and no persecution of homeschooling. I don't like the monopoly of the school system, of the public school system. And I'm pro teacher, I'm pro education, but I am not pro state control. You and I have a lot of libertarian leaning, Stephen. Where those two circles cross, I think you and I are probably at the 70% mark now.
Well, again, when I grew up, PK, public education educated. It's not to it today. You know, if you live in a more affluent suburb in cities like Chicago, New York, anywhere, you will find public schools that really do educate. But if you live inner cities, they do not. Well, they did when I grew up. Poor kids could get an education just like better off kids. It's simply running things right. It's having a system. I mean, why could it work so well when I was a boy growing up, and today the exact same system produces the opposite result? Why does it have to be that way?
I think it's deliberate. I think they want a dumbing down of society. And also, I may have mentioned this to you before, to me there's a terrible thing that goes on in the black community. It's resentment against achievement. A lot of blacks young blacks look down on other young blacks who go to school. They say you're being white by getting an education. Man, you're selling out. You're being white. That's the worst thing they can do, because they're in slavery days in some countries. You know, the slaves weren't allowed to learn how to read and write. Only now they've been emancipated for years, and now they're putting down their own who actually care. That has nothing to do with poverty. It's a value system. It's very self-destructive.
Well, again, absolutely, I agree. And you literally could have any system, PK, and you can run it properly, or you could run it improperly. And I agree with you that the system today is designed to dumb people down. Instead of educating them, the idea is forget about them. Well, look what's going on, PK. What opportunity, if you educate everybody well today and there are no jobs, what are you going to do with these kids? You've got kids coming out of college today with a college degree, with a graduate degree, with a PhD, and there's no job for them.
Yeah, it's awful. Stephen, thank you for all the conversation we've just had on these the topics we're jumping from, because I enjoy jumping from topics to topics, especially with someone like you who can hang in there with me. Now let's move on to you and I.
Can I mention one more thing before we
move
on?
Sure, please, please.
It was a hanging thread for me talking about the economy. Money printing itself does not cause inflation. The government could print all the money it wants. And it did in the Civil War, in colonial America, as long as that money is used for productive economic growth. In other words, it's the old law of supply and demand. If supply and demand are in balance, you won't get inflation. But if there's too much money chasing too few goods, now you've got a major problem. So you need to keep the two in balance. That's the idea of inflation. I think most people may not realize. Well, most people aren't economists, but this has worked very well. They literally could run the printing presses, PK, as much as they want, crank out as much money, gold back, not gold back, as long as that money is put into the economy to create growth, create jobs, produce industry, use it productively, then it works. But, of course, it's not done for that purpose. Anyway, I'm ready to move on.
Okay, because I disagree with you about a lot of that. But anyway, thanks. Let's move on to you and I, one of our most favorite topics, foreign policy. Hasn't our federal government done a wonderful job? And look what they've done within the last week. They have now slaughtered about 24 Pakistani soldiers. What a way to win friends and influence people. And I'm sure they're just sorry because it's collateral damage. But look what that's causing. Are they that clueless? You know, the politicians in the military, are they that clueless about what they're doing to further this whole stupid globalist empire?
They don't care, PK. I mean, they have their agenda. Human beings are inconsequential. It's been a while, maybe a year and a half ago, I wrote an article about the use of drones in warfare, and they're getting more extreme all the time. And one of the startling statistics that I came up with, it really is shocking, and again, too few people know this stuff. For every so-called militant killed, 50 civilians are killed, a ratio of 50-1. And estimates over and over again point out exactly the same thing. So whenever these drone attacks strike, you know, Pakistani soldiers, they fall into another category. You know, you're killing your own. I mean, do they really want to kill these guys? I mean, it's hard to believe. But let's say it was an accident. There are a lot of accidents. You know, I mean, you could somebody manning a TV console, a computer console, sitting anywhere. I mean, they can be in the war theater. They can be halfway around the world. They're doing all of this on a computer screen with a computer keyboard, and they can home in pretty close on targets. But basically, you know, I mean, they've got these drones up there, and they're unleashing these strikes. And usually, they think they're aiming at something they want to destroy. But they don't really know. I mean, they see a target that they say, we want to destroy this target, but is it really the enemy that you'll be destroying? Or do you think it's the enemy, but it, in fact it is not? So massive numbers of civilians are killed. People are enraged about what's going on. And then you have a public incident like killing a couple of dozen Pakistani soldiers. I wonder how long the Pakistan anger will rage at us. I have a feeling it'll subside, because I remember when the Afghan war began, one of the undersecretaries of defense, I believe. Oh, I know his name so well, and I can't spit it off the tip of my tongue. Anyway, he went to Pakistan, and he said to the general, Musharraf, I guess. General Musharraf. they all sound alike to me. PK. Musharraf, I believe his name was. He's gone now. He said to him, I will give you a choice. We'll either give you billions of dollars in aid, military aid, of course, or we'll bomb you to dust.
Well, Stephen,
it was an easy choice.
Stephen, I got news for you, my friend, and maybe it isn't news. Those drones are coming here domestically, too. Maybe not with the bombing aspect, but the intervention, the surveillance, that whole thing is coming here.
Oh, it's here right now.
Stephen, not just on our borders. Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We live in a surveillance society. And it happens at the federal level. It happens at the local level. In my own city of Chicago, PK, Chicago has got cameras all over the place, on the streets, shopping malls, in buildings, in my own building, on my elevator. They've got cameras. In the corridors, they've got cameras. I mean, I feel like somebody's watching me all the time. I feel like the next thing is they're going to say, we're putting a camera in your bedroom, in your bathroom, in your kitchen, in your living room.
Wow.
This is the kind of society we live in.
It'll be your own reality show that you do not approve of.
That's exactly right.
Well, Stephen, let's go back to the Middle East a little bit here. Now it looks like they want Syria to fall now. That's their next their move.
I really fear another war coming. You know, first we had Afghanistan, Iraq, then the war against Libya. I call them all Obama's wars.
Oh, yeah, and they're circling the wagons for Iran.
Well, Iran would be the next one. First, to separate Syria from Iran. The targeted countries, at least some of them, include Syria, Iran, northern Sudan. Sudan was Balkanized. The south was split off from the north. South has most of the oil. Darfur region has oil. That's the reason Darfur gets into the news. Hasn't been lately. It's not because anybody in America or the West cares about people being killed. And the whole Darfur story was completely mistold. But the issue is resources. America wants to control the world's resources, not have access to them, control them. And a key area, of course, is the Middle East, Central Asia, extremely rich, mainly in oil and gas, and America wants to control them, give access to U.S. corporations, control the price, decide who gets the oil, who does not get the oil. That's what the game is all about. So Libya was destroyed. Syria may be the next country. Then Iran would be the crown jewel, because it has, I think it's the third largest supplier of oil in the world. It has the second largest natural gas resources after Russia. So America covets what Iran has, and sooner or later they want to do something to replace the government, replace it with a client state. We don't care if a government is secular or Islamist or anything else, PK. The only thing we care about is it or is it not a client state? So the most repressive Islamist state probably anywhere is Saudi Arabia. It is a rock-solid U.S. ally. It's even an ally of Israel. Covertly, they have no overt relations.
Yeah.
But under the table, they have a relationship. They get along together. And if push comes to shove, they will be allies. And a country like Syria, an authoritarian state, but most people could live there very nicely.
It's a secular,
we're peace
secular
and calm
country.
You and I could live there, have no problem in the world. You could go to a city like Damascus, the capital. Nobody would bother you. In fact, most of the people in Damascus and the largest city in the country, Aleppo, support the Assad government. Well, I don't believe in a one-party state, although I certainly don't believe in what we call democracy, because we don't have democracy. We have rhetorical democracy.
Let me quote the great Stephen Lenman here, who told me a while back, he said, you know, about Libya, he said, well, if you're going to have a dictator, you know, as bad as dictators are, he'd probably be the one you'd want, you know, and that made sense to me, because what have they done? They've destroyed, the globalists have destroyed a secular Iraq. Okay, Saddam fought against fundamentalism for 30 years. They destroyed a secular Libya. Now they're going to try to destroy a secular Syria. And one thing I want to mention, Stephen, about Libya is they kicked out the Chinese. That's another thing Uncle Sam's up to, the federal government, trying to kick the Chinese out of everywhere. They don't like them as competitors. But China's acting more capitalistically. They're buying. They're signing deals and contracts. They're not sending military to intimidate people and blow people up.
Well, why we still call China communist China is beyond me. I mean, it absolutely is a free market country. The difference between China is, well, China is very much like us politically, PK. You know, we call ourselves a democracy and go through the theater of elections that really are a little more than theater. They don't amount to anything, but we hold them, and people actually think that we have legitimate elections. In China, it's different. They have a ruling party, and it stays a ruling party. So they strip away the theater and basically have the same system that we do. A very capitalist country. The reason we target China is because they are catching us, and according to the IMF, by 2016, they will match us economically based on a purchase price basket of goods. In other words, what it costs to buy things in Chinese yuan versus what it costs to buy them in deflated dollars. When you debase your currency, it buys less, and the Chinese yuan is not debased the way the dollar does. So based on a purchase price basis, China will catch America in 2016, and that was one of the sins that Dominique Strauss-Kahn committed when he ran the IMF. That was a very, very unkind thing to say to America. Well, they got even with him, didn't they?
Well, yeah, yeah, I'm opposed to all this stuff that's going down, and I certainly don't want war with Iran, which my acronym for Iran stands for Israel Requires American Naivety. That's what Iran stands for. I do not want to attack Iran. There's no reason to attack Iran. I don't know if you know this, but Ahmadinejad never said he wanted to wipe Israel off the map. His translation was more like he would hope to see the Zionist regime fade from the pages of history, just as the former Soviet Union did. Meanwhile, there's over 25,000 Jews, Iranian Jews, living in Iran who are not threatened and live peacefully in the country, which the globalists and the Zionists like to overlook.
Oh, absolutely right. I have written about what Ahmadinejad said. I think he made more than one statement. And one of the things he did about Israel being destroyed was he said, if Israel continues to pursue its policies, it will self-destruct. And I agree with that. Israel will self-destruct. You know who else has said that? And I don't know how this came out, but the CIA said the same thing. They said that within two decades, Israel's self-destructive policies will end up destroying the country. CIA and Ahmadinejad agree with each other.
I'm glad to see that it has its back against the wall, Israel, because to me it's a terrorist apartheid state. And talk about a Jewish ghetto. They've made their biggest Jewish ghetto in the world, and they got walls around it that they built with American tax funding. And Israel is the most dangerous country in the world for Jews to live in.
It really is, and it's also a very unfair country, including for Jews. Last summer, there were weeks of social justice protests because Israel and Britain of all of the I believe OECD countries, including America, or at least the Western ones, Israel and Britain are the two most economically unequal. The wealth disparity in Israel is extreme. Of course, it is in America as well, and it is in the UK. So if you're well off in Israel, you can do very nicely. But for ordinary working Israelis, are they getting priced out of the ability to pay rent or own a home? They can't afford to do the basic things to take care of their families. And this ignited an unprecedented series of protests last summer.
We saw them.
All over the country, just like our Occupy Wall Street protests, and they ebbed. But I expect them to come back again because people are extremely angry. And this wasn't the Israel that existed years ago. People are being marginalized and shut out. And the Israeli governments are doing nothing to help people. So Israel is not only a racist apartheid state, it's also a state that harms the Jewish people. What kind of a place is that?
Stephen, it's not the kind of place I'd want to live in. And you know what, Stephen? If they knew your background and your writings, you'd be there. You'd probably be about as welcome in Israel as Norman Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky. And they're not allowed there. Well, what violence have they committed? What terrorist acts have they committed to that great democracy? What, because they're writers and authors and intellectuals? That great state of democracy of Israel won't allow them in the country? I'm sure they wouldn't like your writings too much, Stephen.
I don't think they would let me in, PK. I can't imagine they don't know about me because I write continuously about Israel-Palestine, and it gets spread pretty well across the Internet. They have to know about me. They're probably dying to get their hands on me for a few days, you know,
sure,
to show me some Israeli hospitality before they give me the boot out of the country.
You're right. You're right. Are you familiar with he's a former Israeli, and he's a brilliant jazz musician, but he lives in England now. Do you know about Gilad Atzmon?
I sure do.
I'm a big fan.
I had him on my program once.
I'm reading his book now, The Wandering Who.
Oh, we talked about his book at my program.
Which brings me to another topic, Stephen, and we haven't ever done this yet, but I would like to have you on again, but I want to talk mostly about Israel, Zionism, Jewish power, anti-Semitism, the history of Israel, and I want to get into some of that stuff. I might even know a few things that you might not be hip to, in other words.
Oh, well, you really whet my appetite. I would love to do that. It's a major issue for me. And I learn new stuff all the time, PK. I'm sure you know things that I don't, that I should know. And if you can teach them to me, I am all ears.
Well, I'm a very big fan of Jewish anti-Zionist authors, activists, and intellectuals. I've been reading the works of anti-Zionist Jews. So for anyone to label, hypothetically, Stephen Lendman anti-Semitic is madness. It makes no sense at all. If you cannot criticize and speak freely, and you don't advocate violence, you're like me, Stephen. Yours is a constant expose on power, regardless of who wields it or who yields it. Am I right?
Absolutely. I believe in nonviolence. I call Zionism what it is. It's a cancer. It's a cancer that's destroying Israel. It's a malignancy. It's spreading. It needs to be expunged. And it has nothing to do with Judaism. It's all about violence and conquest and slaughter and destruction. That's what Zionism is.
And this is the same thing that an organization I admire, they may be small in number, but that doesn't mean that they are incorrect. And I'm a big fan of Jews United Against Zionism. And I've read their stuff. I'm a fan of Rabbi David Weiss. Very interesting things. Of course, they're hated by a lot of other rabbis and a lot of other Jews. So I would like to have this discussion with you next time because, and I am patronizing you here because I can. You obviously have a Jewish background, but you can take criticism. You can handle debate. You can handle friendly, peaceful discussion. You're not going to wet your pants and call me an anti-Semite because we're going to talk about history and we're going to talk innocently about what we think is right and wrong, what path we should go down, these sort of things. But I do want to get into it with you deeply next time.
Yes, I guess we've come to the end of the program. Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that,
yeah. Yeah, thank you so much. And again, my Jewish friend, patronizing you again. Like I've told you once before, you're always welcome at my house. I buy you a drink, and I take you to dinner anytime. And if that's anti-Semitism, then I'm laughing in the face of it. But, Stephen, thank you so much again for coming on my show. I got to cut us off now. Really appreciate your wisdom and your humor and your insights and especially your friendship. And we've never met face-to-face, my friend, but that day is coming.
Oh, PK, I feel exactly the same way. We are kindred spirits, absolutely.
We really are. So thank you so much again. I'm going to sign off now, everyone. This is your humble host, PK, saying good night and goodbye for now. Please join us again every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, and 11:55 Eastern here on Third Stream View. Until next week, good night, everyone.